takes a good footy for a wee laddie, eh? There he is, the wee felly. The next photograph showed Kevin dressed in a Scotland football strip, on my shoulders.
What have you fucking done?
It was a sound rather than a voice. It seemed to come from an unspecific part of his decaying body rather than his mouth. The unearthliness of it stung me. But I made the effort to continue sounding nonchalant. Basically this. I produced the third photo. It showed Kevin bound to a kitchen chair. His head hung heavily to one side, and his eyes were closed. Had Venters looked at the detail, he may have noticed a bluish tint to his son's eyelids and lips, and the almost clownish whiteness of his complexion. It's almost certain that all Venters noticed were the dark wounds on his head, chest, and knees, and the blood which oozed from them, covering his body, at first making it hard to note that he was naked. The blood was everywhere. It covered the lino in a dark puddle underneath Kevin's chair. Some of it shot outwards across the kitchen floor in squirted trails. An assortment of power tools, including a Bosch drill and a Black & Decker sander, in addition to various sharpened knives and screwdrivers, were laid out at the feet of the upright body.
No. No. Kevin. For God's sake, no. He done nothing. He hurt Nimdy. No!
He moaned on, an ugly, whingy sound devoid of hope or humanity. I gripped his thin hair crudely and wrenched his head up from the pillow. I observed in perverse fascination as the bony skull seemed to sink to the bottom of the loose skin. I thrust the picture in his face. I thought that young Kev should be just like Daddy. So when I got bored fucking your old girlfriend, I decided I'd give wee Kev one up his, tradesman's entrance. I thought if HIV's good enough for Daddy, it's good enough for his brat.
Kevin! Kevin! He groaned on.
Unfortunately, his arsehole was a bit too tight for me, so I had to extend it a little with the masonry drill. Sadly, I got a wee bit carried away and started making holes all over the place. It's just that he reminded me so much of you, Al. I'd love to see that it was painless, but I canny. At least it was relatively quick. Quicker than rotting away in a bed, it took him about 20 minutes to die. 20 screaming, miserable minutes. Poor Kev. As you says, Al, it's a disease which kills the innocent. Tears rolled down his cheeks. He kept saying no over and over again in low, choking sobs. His head jerked in my grip. Worried that the nurse would come, I pulled out one of the pillows from behind him. The last word wee Kevin says was, "Daddy." That was your bairn's last words, Al. "Sorry, pal. Daddy's away." That was what I told him. "Daddy's away." I looked straight into his eyes, all pupils, just a black void of fear and total defeat. I pushed his head back down and put the pillow over his face, stifling the sickening moans. I held it firmly down and pressed my head on it, half gasping, half singing the paraphrased words of an old Boney M song. "Daddy, Daddy cool, Daddy, Daddy cool. You've been a fucking fool. Bye-bye, Daddy Cool." I merrily sang until Venter's feeble resistance subsided. Keeping the pillow firmly over his face, I pulled a Penthouse magazine off his locker. The bastard would have been too weak to even turn the pages, let alone raise a wank. However, his homophobia was so strong that he'd probably kept it on prominent display to make some absurd statement about his sexuality. Rotting away, and his greatest concern is that nobody thinks he's a bufty. I set the magazine on the pillow and thumbed through it in a leisurely manner before taking Venter's pulse. Nothing. He'd checked out. More importantly, he'd done it in a state of tortured, agonized misery. Taking the pillow off the corpse, I pulled its ugly, frail head forward, then let it fall back. For a few moments I contemplated what I saw before me. The eyes were open, as was the mouth. It looked stupid, a sick caricature of a human being. I suppose that's what corpses are. Mind you, Venter's always was. My searing scorn quickly gave way to a surge of sadness. I couldn't quite determine why that should have happened. I looked away from the body. After sitting for another couple of minutes, I went to tell the nurse that Venter's had left the stadium. I attended Venter's funeral at Seafield Crematorium with Francis. It was an emotional time for her, and I felt obliged to lend support. It was never an event destined to break any attendance records. His mother and sister showed up, as did Tom, with a couple of punters from HIV and Positive. The minister could find little decent to say about Venter's, and to his credit, he didn't bullshit. It was a short and sweet performance. Alan had made many mistakes in his life, he said. Nobody was contradicting him. Alan would, like all of us, be judged by God, who would grant him salvation. It is an interesting notion, but I feel that the gaffer in the sky has a fair bit of graft ahead of him if that bastard's checked in up there. If he has, I think I'll take my chances in the other place, thank you very much. Outside, I checked out the wreaths. Venter's only had one. Alan, love Mum and Sylvia. To my knowledge, they had never visited him in the hospice. Very wise of them. Some people are easier to love when you don't have to be around them. I pumped the hands of Tom and the others, then took Fran and Kev for some deluxe ice cream at Lucas in Musselburgh. Obviously, I had deceived Venter's about the things I did to Kevin. Unlike him, I'm not a fucking animal. I'm far from proud about what I did do. I took great risks with the bairn's well-being. Working in a hospital operating theatre, I know all about the crucial role of the anaesthetist. They're the punters that keep you alive, not sadistic fuckpigs like Howison. After the jab puts you under, you're kept unconscious by the anaesthetic and put onto a life support system. All your vital signs are monitored in highly controlled conditions. They take care. Chloroform is much more of a blunt instrument and very dangerous. I still shudder when I think of the risk I took with the wee man. Thankfully, Kevin woke up with only a sore head and some bad dreams as a remnant of his trip to the kitchen. The joke shop and Humbrol enamel paints provided the wounds. I worked wonders with Fran's makeup and talc for Kev's death mask. My greatest coup, though, was the 3 plastic pint bags of blood I took from the fridge in the path lab at the hospital. I got paranoid when that fucker Howison gave me the evil eyes as I walked down the corridor past him. He always does, though. I think it's because I once addressed him as Doctor instead of Mister. He's a funny cunt. Most surgeons are. You'd have to be to do that job. Like Tom's job, I suppose. Putting Kevin under turned out to be easy. The biggest problem I had was setting up and dismantling the entire scene inside half an hour. The most difficult part involved cleaning him up before getting him back to bed. I had to use tarps as well as water. I spent the rest of the night cleaning up the kitchen before Francis got back. It was worth the effort, however. The pictures looked authentic. Authentic enough to fuck up Venters. Since I helped Al on his way to the great gig in the sky, life has been pretty good. Francis and I have gone our separate ways. We were never really compatible. She only really saw me as a babysitter and a wallet. For me, obviously, the relationship became largely superfluous after Venter's death. I miss Kev more. It makes me wish that I had a kid. Now that'll never be. One thing that Fran did say was that I had revived her faith in men after Venters. Ironically, it seems as if I found my role in life, cleaning up that prick's emotional garbage. My health, touch wood, has been good. I'm still asymptomatic. I fear colds and get obsessive from time to time, but I take care of myself. Apart from the odd can of beer, I never bevy. I watch what I eat and have a daily program of light exercises. I get regular blood checks and pay attention to my T4 count. It's still way over the crucial 800 mark. In fact, it's not gone down at all. I'm now back with Donna, who inadvertently acted as the conduit for HIV between me and Venters. We found something that we probably wouldn't have got from each other in different circumstances. Or maybe we would. Anyway, we don't analyse it, not having the luxury of time. However, I must give old Tom at the group his due. He said that I'd have to work through my anger, and he was right. I took the quick route, though, by sending Venters to oblivion. Now all I get is a bit of guilt. But I can handle that. I eventually told my parents about my being HIV positive. My ma just cried and held me. The old man said nothing. The colour had drained from his face as he sat and watched A Question of Sport. When he was pressed by his wailing wife to speak, he just said, "Well, there's nothing to say." He kept repeating that sentence. He never looked me in the eye. That night, back at my flat, I heard the buzzer go. Assuming it to be Donna, who had been out, I opened the stair and house doors. A few minutes later, my old man stood in the doorway with tears in his eyes. It was the first time he'd ever been to my flat. He moved over to me and held me in a crushing grip, sobbing and repeating, "My laddie." It felt a world or two better than, "Well, there's nothing to say." I cried loudly and unselfconsciously. As with Donna, so with my family. We have found an intimacy which may have otherwise eluded us. I wish I hadn't waited so long to become a human being. Better late than never, though. Believe you me. There's some kids playing out in the back, the strip of grass illuminated an electric green by the brilliant sunlight. The sky is a delicious clear blue. Life is beautiful. I'm going to enjoy it, and I'm going to have a long life. I'll be what the medical staff call a long-term survivor. I just know that I will.
Chapter 26. There is a light that never goes out. They emerge from the stair door into the darkness of the deserted street. Some of them move in a jerky, manic way, exuberant and noisy. Others cruise along silently, like ghosts, hurting inside, yet fearful of the imminence of even greater pain and discomfort. Their destination is a pub which seems to prop up a crumbling tenement set on a side street between Easter Road and Leith Walk. This street has missed out on the stone-cleaning process its neighbours have enjoyed, and the building is the sooty black colour of a 40-a-day man's lungs. The night is so dark that it is difficult to establish the outline of the tenement against the sky. It can only be defined through an isolated light glaring from a top-floor window or the luminous street lamp jutting out from its side. The pub's façade is painted a thick, glossy, dark blue, and its sign is the early 70s design favoured by its brewing chain when the paradigm was that every bar had to have a standard look and play down any individual character it might have. Like the tenement above and around it, the pub has enjoyed nothing other than the most superficial maintenance for almost 20 years. It is 5:06 a.m., and the hostelry's yellow lights are on, a haven in the dark, wet, and lifeless streets. It had been, Spud reflects, a few days since he'd seen the light. They were like vampires, living a largely nocturnal existence, completely out of synchronization with most of the other people who inhabited the tenements and lived by a rota of sleep and work. It was good to be different. Despite the fact that its doors have only been open for a few minutes, the pub is busy. Inside there is a long formica-topped bar with several pumps and fonts. Battered tables in the same formica style stand shakily on dirty lino. Behind the bar towers an incongruously grandiose, finely carved wooden gantry. Sickly yellow light from the shadeless bulbs bounces harshly off the nicotine-stained walls. The pub contains bona fide shift workers from the brewery and the hospital, and this is as it should be, given the avowed purpose of the early license. There is also a smattering, however, of the more desperate, those who are there because they need to be. The group entering the pub are also driven by need. The need for more alcohol to maintain the high or to regain it and fight off the onset of grim, depressive hangovers. They are also drawn by a greater need, the need to belong to each other, to hold on to whatever force has fused them together during the last few days of partying. Their entry to the pub is observed by an indeterminately old drunkard who is propped up against the bar. The man's face has been destroyed by the consumption of cheap spirits and overexposure to the frozen wind blasting cruelly from the North Sea. It seems as if every blood vessel in it has ruptured under the skin, leaving it resembling the undercooked square sausages served up in the local cafes. His eyes are a contrasting cool blue, although the whites of them are the identical colour of the pub walls. His face strains in vague recognition as the noisy group move up to the bar. One of the young men, perhaps more than one, he sardonically thinks, is his son. He had been responsible for bringing quite a few of them into the world at one time, when a certain type of woman found him attractive. That was before the drink had destroyed his appearance and distorted the output of his cruel, sharp tongue to an incomprehensible growl. He looks at the young man in question and considers saying something, before deciding that he has nothing to say to him. He never had. The young man doesn't even see him, his attention focused on getting in the drinks. The old drunkard sees that the young man enjoys his company and his drink. He remembers when he himself was in that position. The enjoyment and the company faded away, but the drink didn't. In fact, it expanded to fill the gap left by their departure. The last thing Spud wants is another pint. Prior to their departure, he had examined his face in the bathroom mirror back in Dawsey's flat. It was pale, yet marked with blotches, with heavy, hooded eyelids attempting to draw the shutters on reality. This face was topped by sticking up tufts of sandy hair. It might be an idea, he considers, to have a tomato juice for his aching guts, or a fresh orange and lemonade to combat his dehydration before drinking alcohol again. The hopelessness of the situation is confirmed when he mildly accepts the pint of lager Frank Begbie, first to the bar, had got up.
"Cheers, Franco." "Guinness for me, Franco," Renton requests. He has just returned from London. He feels as good to be back as he did to get away in the first place.
"The Guinness is shite in here," Gaff Temperley tells him.
"Still, though..."
Dawsey is raising his eyebrows and singing at the barmaid.
"Yeah, yeah, yeah, you're a beautiful lover."
They'd had a crappiest song competition, and Dawsey hadn't stopped singing his winning entry.
"Shut the fuck up, Dawsey," Alison nudges him in the ribs. "You want to get us flung out?"
The barmaid is ignoring him anyway. He turns to sing at Renton instead. Renton just smiles wearily. He considers that the trouble with Dawsey is that if you encourage him, he'll tear the arse out of a situation. It was mildly amusing a couple of days ago, and in any case, he feels, it had not been as funny as his own version of Rupert Holmes' Escape, the Pina Colada song.
"I can remember the night when we met down in Rio. That Guinness is fucking loupin'. You're mad getting Guinness in here, Mark."
"Tell them," Gav says, triumphantly.
"Or the same, but," Renton replies, a lazy grin still on his face. He feels drunk. He feels Kelly's hand inside his shirt, tweaking his nipple. She'd been doing that to him all night, telling him that she really liked flat, hairless chests. It feels good having his nipples touched. By Kelly, it feels better than good.
"Vodka and tonic," she says to Begbie, who gestures to her from the bar. "Gin and lemonade for Ally. She's just away to the bog."
Spud and Gav continue talking at the bar while the rest grab some seats in the corner.
"How's June?"
Kelly asks Franco Begbie, referring to his girlfriend, suspected to be pregnant again after having just recently given birth to a child.
"Who?"
Franco shrugs aggressively. End of conversation. Renton looks up at the early morning program on the television.
"That and Diamond. Eh?"
Kelly looks at him.
"I'd fucking shag it," Begbie says.
Alison and Kelly raise their eyebrows and look to the ceiling.
"No, but our bairn had that court death, same as Leslie's bairn, wee Dawn."
"That was a real shame," Kelly says.
"Good thing, really, but wee lassie would have died of fucking AIDS if it hadn't died of court death. Easier fucking death for a bairn," Begbie states.
"Leslie did not have HIV. Dawn was a perfectly healthy baby."
Alison hisses at him, enraged. Despite being upset himself, Renton cannot not help noting that Alison always speaks posh when she is angry. He feels a vague surge of guilt at being so trivial. Begbie is grinning.
"Wish to say, though,"
Dawsey says sycophantically. Renton looks at him with a hard, challenging stare, which he'd never dare do with Begbie. Aggression displaced to where it will not be reciprocated.
"All I'm saying is, nae cunt really kens,"
Dawsey shrugs tamely. At the bar, Spud and Gav are slurring a conversation together.
"Reckon Rent's so shag Kelly?" Gav asks.
"Dunno. She's finished with that Des dude, like say, and Rent's isn't seeing Hazel now. Free agents and that, like say, Ken."
"That cunt Des. I hate that wanker."
"Don't know the cat, like say, Ken.
You fucking do, he's your fucking cousin, Spud. Dez. Dez Feeney.
Right, man. That Dez. Still didn't really ken the boy. Only likes he run into the gadge a couple of times since we were ankle biters, ken. It's heavy, though. He's all being at the party with that other guy likes and rents with Kelly, ken. Heavy.
That Hazel's a toad-faced cow, anyway. I've never seen that lassie with a smile on her face. Nae wonder, mind you, gone out with rents. Can he be much fun hanging around with some cunt as high was bombed out his box?
Yeah, Lexi, it's too heavy.
Spud briefly wonders whether or not Gav is having an indirect dig at him by going on about people who are always bombed, before deciding that it's an innocent remark. Gav was all right. Spud's muddled brain turns to sex. Everyone seemed to bag off at the party, everyone except him. He really fancies a ride. His problem is that he is too shy when straight or sober and too incoherent when stoned or drunk to make an impression on women. He currently has a thing about Nicola Hanlon, whom he thinks looks a bit like Kylie Minogue. A few months ago, Nicola had been talking to him as they walked from a party at Sight Hill to one at Wester Hales. They had been having a good crack, becoming detached from the rest of the group. She had been very responsive, and Spud had chatted freely, high on speed. In fact, she seemed to be hanging on his every word. Spud wanted to never get to that party, wishing that they could just go on walking and talking. They went down into the underpass, and Spud thought that he should try to put his arm around Nicola. Then a passage from a Smith song, one he'd always liked, called "There Is a Light That Never Goes Out," came into his head. And in the darkened underpass, I thought, oh God, my chance has come at last. But then a strange fear gripped me, and I just couldn't ask. Morris's sad voice summed up his feelings. He didn't put his arm around Nicola, and his attempts to chat her up were half-arsed after that. Instead, he jacked up in a bedroom with Rents and Matty, enjoying blissful freedom from the anxiety of wondering whether or not he'd get off with her. When sex did happen for Spud, it was generally when he was possessed by a more forceful will. Even then, disaster never seemed to be too far away. One evening, Laura McEwen, a girl with an awesome sexual reputation, grabbed a hold of him in a Grassmarket pub and took him home. "I want you to take my arse virginity," she told him. "Eh?" Spud could not believe it. "Fuck me in the arse. I've never done it that way before."
Yeah, that sounds... Barry, Lexi, right.
Spud felt like the chosen one. He knew that Sick Boy, Renton and Matty had all been with Laura, who tended to attach herself to a company, fuck every guy in it, and then move on. The thing was, they had never done what he was about to do. However, Laura wanted to do some things with Spud first. She bound his wrists, then his ankles together with sellotape.
"I'm doing this because I don't want you to hurt me. Do you understand? We do it from the side. The minute I start to feel pain, it's fucking over, right? Because nobody hurts me. No fucking guy ever hurts me. You understand me?"
She spoke harshly and bitterly.
"Yeah. Sound like she sound,"
Spud said. He didn't want to hurt anyone. He was shocked at the imputation. Laura stood back and admired her handiwork.
"Fuck me, that's beautiful," she said,
rubbing her crotch as a naked Spud lay trussed up on the bed. Spud felt vulnerable and strangely coy. He'd never been tied up before and never been told that he was beautiful.
Laura then took Spud's long, thin cock into her mouth and started to suck him off. She stopped with an expertise part intuitive, part learned, just before an ecstatic Spud was about to come. Then she left the room. Spud started to get paranoid about the bondage. Everyone said Laura was a nutter. She'd been shagging everyone in sight since she'd got a long-term partner, a guy called Roy, committed to a psychiatric hospital, fed up with his impotence, incontinence, and depression. But mostly the former. "He never fucked me properly for ages," Laura had told Spud, as if that was justification for getting him banged up in the nut house. However, Spud reasoned, her cruelty and ruthlessness was part of her attraction. Sick Boy referred to her as the sex goddess. She came back into the bedroom and looked at him, bound and at her mercy. "I want you to dee us in the arse now. First, though, I'm going to Vaseline your dick heavily, so that it doesn't hurt me when you put it in. My muscles'll be tight, 'cause this is new to me, but I'll try to relax." She talked hard on a joint. Laura was not being strictly accurate. She couldn't find any Vaseline in the bathroom cabinet. She did, however, find some other stuff she could use as a lubricant. It was sticky and gooey. She applied it liberally to Spud's dick. It was Vic. It burned into him, and Spud screamed in excruciating agony. He writhed fitfully against his bonds, feeling like the tip of his penis had been guillotined off. "Fuck! Sorry, Spud," Laura said, open-mouthed. She helped him off the bed and assisted him into the toilet. He hopped along, tears of pain blinding him. She filled the sink with water and then left the room to search for a knife to cut the binding on his ankles and wrists. Balancing precariously, Spud put his cock into the water. It stung even more violently, the shock making him recoil. As he fell back, his head crashed against the toilet bowl and split open above his eye. When Laura came back, Spud was unconscious, and thick, dark blood was oozing onto the lino. Laura called the ambulance, and Spud woke up in hospital with 6 stitches above his eye, heavily concussed. He never did get to fuck her in the arsehole. The rumour was that a frustrated Laura phoned up Sick Boy shortly after this, who came and stood in for his friend. Soon after this disaster, Spud turned his attention to Nicola Hanlon.
Surprised wee Nicky was near at the party, like say. "Wee Nicky, can I say?" he told Gav. "Aye, she's a dirty wee hoor. Takes it always," Gav said casually. "Aye?"
Noting and savouring the ill-disguised trepidation and concern on Spud's face, Gav continues, gleeful inside, but talking in a stiff, brisk, business-like manner.
"Oh, aye. I've poked her a few times. Not bad wee ride lights. Sick Boy's been there, rents and all. I think Tommy T. He was certainly sniffing round it for a bit."
"Aye? Right."
Spud feels deflated, and optimistic at the same time. He'll have to try to stay straighter, he resolves, thinking that he seems to miss everything that is going on under his nose. Over at the table, Begbie indicates that he is in need of more solid nourishment.
"I'm fucking Lee Marvin. Let's get some scran, then hit a decent fucking boozer."
He looks bitterly around the cavernous, nicotine-stained bar, like an arrogant aristocrat finding himself in reduced circumstances. In fact, he has just seen the old drunkard at the bar. It is still dark when they leave the pub and go to a cafe in Portland Street.
"Full breakfast or unt?"
Begbie enthusiastically looks at the others. They all nod approvingly, except Renton.
"No, I'm no wanting meat," he says.
"I'll have your fucking bacon and sausage and fucking black pudding then," Begbie suggests.
"Aye, sure," Renton says sarcastically.
"I'll fucking swap you my fucking egg and beans and tomato then, you cunt."
"All right,
begins Renton. Then he turns to the waitress. Did you use vegetable oil when you fry, or fat?
No, fat, the waitress says, looking at him as if he is an imbecile.
Monty, fuck, Rents. Makes no difference, Gav says. Sup to Mark what he eats, Kelly says supportively.
Alison nods. Renton feels like a smug pimp.
Fucking well spoiling it for every cunt, Rents, Begbie growls. How am I spoiling it?
Cheese salad roll, he turns to the waitress.
We all fucking agreed. Full fucking breakfast so ruined, Begbie states.
Renton cannot believe this. He wants to tell Begbie to fuck off. Instead, he fights the instinct and slowly shakes his head.
I didn't eat meat, Franco. Fucking vegetarianism. Fucking loady shite. You need meat. A fucking junkie fucking worrying about what he puts in his body. That's a fucking laugh.
Just any light meat, Renton says, feeling silly as they all snigger.
Didn't he fucking tell us you hate killing fucking animals? Remember the fucking dogs and cats we used to fucking shoot with air rifles? And the fucking pigeons we used to set on fire? Used to fucking tape bangers, fireworks like, to white mice, this cunt.
No bothered about killing animals, just didn't like eating them, Renton shrugs, embarrassed that his adolescent cruelties have been exposed to Kelly.
Fucking cruel bastards. Didn't he ken how anybody could shoot a dog?
Alison sneers, shaking her head.
Well, I didn't ken how anybody could kill and eat a pig.
Renton points to the bacon and sausage on her plate.
It's no the same.
Spud looks around.
It's, like, see, Rents is doing the right thing, but it's kindy the wrong reasons. We'll never, like, see, learn to love ourselves until we can look after weaker things, like, see, animals and that. But it's good that Rents is vegetarian. Like, see, if you can keep it up. Like, see.
Begbie vibrates his body in a floppy way and gives the peace sign to Spud. The others laugh. Renton, appreciative at Spud's attempt to back him up, cuts in to deflect the slagging away from his ally.
Keeping it up's no problem. I just hate meat. It makes us puke, end of story. Well, I still fucking say you're fucking spoiling it for every cunt else.
How?
'Cause I fucking says that's fucking how,
Begbie hisses, pointing to himself. Renton shrugs again. There was little sense in arguing further. They hurry the meal down, all except Kelly, who plays with her food, oblivious to the ravenous stares of the others. Eventually she scrapes some bits and pieces onto Franco and Gav's empty plates. They are asked to leave after chanting, "Utu, utubi, utubia, hebi," when a nervous and uncomfortable-looking guy in a Hearts shell top walks in for a takeaway. This sets off a medley of football and crap pop songs. The woman at the counter threatens to phone the police, but they vacate the premises with good grace. They stop off at another pub. Renton and Kelly stay for one drink, then slope off together. Gav, Dawsey, Begbie, Spud and Alison continue drinking heavily. Dawsey, who has been teetering for some time, passes out. Begbie gets in tow with a couple of psychos that he knows at the bar, and Gav has a proprietary arm around Alison. Spud hears Tapao's China in Your Hand starting, and immediately realizes that Begbie is up at the jukebox. He always seemed to put on either that one, Berlin's Take My Breath Away, the Human League's Don't You Want Me, or a Rod Stewart song. When Gav staggers off to the toilet, Alison turns to Spud.
Spud, Danny, let's get out of here. I want to go home.
I didn't want to go home on my own, Danny.
Come with us.
Home, right.
They slink out of the smoke-filled bar as surreptitiously as their wasted bodies allow.
Come home and stay with us for a while, Danny. No drugs or anything. I didn't want to be on my own just now, Danny. Ken what I'm saying? Alison looks at him tensely, tearfully, as they lurch along the street. Spud nods. He thinks he knows what she is saying, because he doesn't want to be alone either. He can never be sure, though. Never, ever quite sure.
Chapter 27. Feeling Free.
Alison's getting really terrible. I'm sitting here with her in this cafe, trying to make sense of the rubbish that she's talking. She's bad-mouthing Mark, which is fair enough, but it's starting to get on my wick. I know that she means well, but what about her and Simon, who just comes along and uses her when he's got nobody else to fuck? She isn't exactly in the best position to talk. Don't you get me wrong, Kelly, I like Mark. It's just that he's got a load of problems. He isn't what you need right now. Ali's being protective because I got fucked about with Des and the abortion and all that. It's such a pain in the arse, though. She should hear herself. Trying to kick heroin and she feels she's in a position to tell everybody else how to live their lives. Oh, aye, and Simon's what you need. I'm no saying that, Kelly. That's nothing to do with it. Simon's at least trying to keep off the smack. Mark doesn't give a toss. Mark isn't a junkie. He just uses sometimes. Ah, sure. What fucking planet are you on, Kelly? That's how that Hazel lassie tore up his cared. He can't leave the gear alone. You're even talking like a junkie yourself. Keep thinking like that, and you'll be on it as well soon enough. I'm no going to argue with her. It's time for her appointment at the housing department anyway. Ali's doing to see about her rent arrears. She's pretty mad-like, screwed up and tense. But the guy behind the desk's all right. Ali explains that she's off the gear and she has been for a few job interviews. It goes quite well. She gets given a set amount to pay back each week. I can tell that Ali's still uptight, though, because of the way she reacts when these guys, workies, whistle at us outside the GPO. "All right, doll," one shouts. Ali, crazy fucking cow that she is, turns on the guy. "Have you got a girlfriend? I doubt it, because you're a fat, ugly prick. Why no just go into the toilet with a dirty book and have sex with the only person crazy enough to touch you, yourself?" The guy looks at her with real hate, but he was looking like that anyway. It's only like now he's got a reason to hate her, rather than just because she's a woman. The guy's mates are going, "Woo! Woo!" sort of egging this guy on, and he's just standing there shaking with anger. One of the workies is dangling like an ape for the scaffolding. That's what they're like, low primates, too mad. "Fuck off, ya boot," he snarls. Ali stands her ground, though. This is embarrassing, but sort of fun and all, because a few people have stopped to check out the hassle. Two other women, like student types with backpacks, are standing alongside us. It makes me feel, like, really good. Crazy! Ali, God, that woman is mental, says, "So, I was a doll a minute ago when you were hassling us. Now that I tell you to fuck off, I'm a boot." "Well, you are still a fat, ugly prick, son, and you always will be." "And so say all of us," one of the backpacker women says in an Australian accent. "Fucking dykes," another guy shouts. That gets right on my tits, getting called a dyke, just because I object to being hassled by revolting, ignorant radgies. "If all guys were as repulsive as you, I'd be fucking proud to be a lesbian, son," I shouts back. Did I really say that? Too mad. "You guys have obviously got a problem. Why don't you just go and fuck each other?" the other Aussie says. Quite a crowd's gathered, and two old wifeys are listening in. "That's terrible. Lassie's talking like that to the laddies," one says. "It's no terrible at all. They're bloody pests. It's good to see young lassies sticking up for themselves. Wish it happened in my day." "The language, though, Hilda, the language." The first wifey puckers her lips and shudders. "Aye, well, what about their language?" I says to her. The guys are looking embarrassed, really shit up by the crowd that's developed. It's sort of like feeding off itself. Crazy. Then this foreman, playing at being fucking Rambo, comes along. "Can't you control these animals?" one of the Aussie women says. "Haven't they got any work to do instead of harassing people?" "Back inside yous," the foreman snaps, gesturing the guys away. We sort of let out a cheer. It was brilliant. Crazy. Me and Ali went back over the road to the Cafe Rio with the Aussies, and the two wifies came along as well. The Aussies actually turned out to be New Zealand lassies who were lesbians, but that's got fuck all to do with anything. They were just travelling around the world together. That's too mad. I'd love to give that a go. Me and Ali, that would be crazy. Imagine coming to Scotland in November, but that is too fundamentally mad. We all just blethered for ages about everything in sight, and even Ali didn't seem so screwed up about things. After a bit, we decided to go back to my place for a smoky hash and some more tea. We tried to get the wifies to come, but they had to go home and get their men's teas on, despite us telling them to let the bastards get their own food. One was really tempted. "I wish I was your age again, hen. I'd do it all different, I can tell you. I'm feeling brilliant. Really likes free. We all are. Magic." Ali, Veronica and Jane, the New Zealanders, and Marcel got really stoned back at my place. We slagged off men, agreeing that they are stupid, inadequate and inferior creatures. I've never felt so close to other women before, and I really did wish I was gay. Sometimes I think that all men are good for is the odd shag. Other than that, they can be a real fucking pain. Maybe that's crazy, but it's true when you think about it. Our problem is, we don't think about it that often and just accept the bullshit these pricks dish out to us. The door goes and it's Mark. I can't help smirking in his face. He comes in looking completely bewildered as we fall about laughing at him, stoned out of our boxes. Maybe it's the dope, but he just looks so strange. Men just look so strange, these funny flat bodies and weird heads. It's like Jane said, they're freaky-looking things that carry their reproductive organs on the outside of their bodies. Pure rag! "All right, doll," Ali shouts in a mock workie's voice. "Get 'em off," Veronica laughs. "I've fucking shagged it. No a bad fucking ride, as I remember. Bit on the fucking small side, likes," I says, pointing at him, impersonating Franco's voice. Frank Begbie, every woman's dream, I don't think, has been getting well slagged by me and Ali. He takes it well, though, poor Mark. I'll say that for him. Just shakes his head and laughs. "I've obviously called at an inconvenient time. I'll gi' you a bell the morn," he says to me. "Oh, poor Mark. We're just having a woman's crack. You ken the score," Ali says guiltily. I laugh out loud at what she said. "Which woman's crack are we having?" I says. We're all falling about laughing wildly. Ali and me maybe should have been born men. We see sex in everything, especially when we're stoned. "It's all right. See yous." He turns and leaves, giving me a wink. "I suppose some of them are okay," Jane says, after we've composed ourselves. "Aye, when they're in the fucking minority they're okay," I says, wondering where the edge in my voice had come from. Then, no wanting to wonder too much.
Chapter 28. The Elusive Mr. Hunt. Kelly is working behind a bar at a punter's pub in the south side. She is kept busy, as it is a popular shop. It is particularly mobbed out this Saturday afternoon when Renton, Spud and Gav call in for a drink. Sick Boy, positioned at the phone in another pub over the road, calls the bar.
"Be with you in a minute, Mark," Kelly says, as Renton goes up to get the drinks in. She picks up the ringing phone. "Rutherford's Bar," she sings.
"Hi,"
says sick boy, disguising his voice, Malcolm Rifkind merchant school style. Is there a Mark Hunt in the bar?
There's a Mark Renton, Kelly tells him. Sick boy thinks for a second that he's been rumbled. However, he carries on.
No, it's Mark Hunt I'm looking for, the plummy voice stresses.
Mark Hunt,
Kelly shouts across the bar. The drinkers, who are almost exclusively male, look around at her, faces breaking into smiles.
Anybody seen Mark Hunt?
Some guys at the bar collapse into loud laughter.
No, but I'd like to, one says.
Kelly still doesn't catch on. With a puzzled expression at the reaction she is getting, she says,
This guy on the phone was after Mark Hunt.
Then her voice tails off, her eyes widen, and she puts her hand to her mouth, understanding at last. He's not the only one, Renton smiles as Sick Boy comes into the pub. They practically have to hold each other up, as they are so overwhelmed with laughter. Kelly throws the half-empty contents of a water jug at them, but they scarcely notice. While it's all a laugh to them, she feels humiliated. She feels bad about feeling bad about not being able to take a joke. Until she realizes that it's not the joke that bothers her, but the men in the bar's reaction to it. Behind the bar, she feels like a caged animal in a zoo who has done something amusing. She watches their faces, distorted into a red, gaping, gloating commonality. The joke is on the woman again, she thinks, the silly wee lassie behind the bar. Renton looks at her and sees her pain and anger. It cuts him up. It confuses him. Kelly has a great sense of humour. What's wrong with her? The knee-jerk thought. Wrong time of the month is forming in his head when he looks about and picks up the intonations of the laughter around the bar. It's not funny laughter. This is lynch mob laughter.
How was that to know? He thinks. How the fuck was that to know?
Part 6. Home. Chapter 29. Easy Money for the Professionals.
It was a piecey pish. A total piecey pish, but likesy Begbie's so fucking uncool, man. I'm telling you, likes.
She fucking nout to knee, cunt mind. Nout to knee, fucker, he says to us.
Likesy reading you loud and clear, man, likesy, crystal clear. Chill out, Franco, man, chill out. We cracked the gig, like, see, Ken.
Aye, but fucking nout to knee cunt. No even fucking rents in that, mind.
There's nae reasoning with some cats. You see reason, they mew treason, Ken.
And nae fucking drugs. Keep the fucking dough back for a bit, he adds.
Now the cat is telling us how to spend the brass, like, see.
This is a tacky scene, likes. We've got a couple of grand apiece after we've pied off the young guy, like say, and this cat's fur's still standing on end.
The beggar boy is one feline we will need just curl up in a nice warm basket and purr.
We down another pint, then call a Joe Baxi. These sports bags were carrying, man. They should have swag on the side of them, instead of Adidas and head, likesy.
Two fucking grand legs, four. Don't you who be terrified, it's just a token of my extreme. As the other Franco, one Mr. Zappa, would say.
The taxi takes us to Begbie's. June's in, and she's got the Begbie ankle biter up on her lap.
Bein' woke, she says to Franco, like say she's explaining.
Franco looks at her like he wants to kill them both.
Fuck's sake, come on, Spud, the fucking bedroom. Can't even get a bit of fucking peace in your own fucking house.
He gestures to the door like.
What's all this?
June asks. Dinny fucking ask. Just you fucking see to your fucking bairn. Begbie snaps.
Now why he says it, it's like, see, it's no his bairn and all, Ken.
I suppose in a way he's right, like, see. Franco's no what you'd really sort of call the parental type, Ken. Hey, what sort of type is Franco? It was beautiful, though, man. Nae violence, nae hassle, Ken. A set of dummy keys, and we just, like, see, walked in. This was the false panel in the flare tile behind the counter, under the till, and there was that big canvas bag full of that lovely poppy. Peachy! Oh, the beautiful notes and coins. My passport to better times, man. My passport to better times.
The doorbell rings. Me and Franco are a bit shit up in case it's a lab dex, but it turns out to be the wee gadge up for his cut. Just as well, like, see, cos Franco and me's got coins and notes o'er the bed, divvying up, like, see, Ken.
Yous get it, the wee dude says, eyes then wide in disbelief at the sight of the goodies on the bed.
Sit fucking down. You shut your fucking puss about this, right?
Franco growls. The wee guy shite us, like, see. I want to tell Franco to go easy on the kiddo, Ken. That's, like, see, the kitten that turned us onto this bread.
The wee guy told us his story, even slipped us the keys to copy, like, see.
Even though I seen outlights, the Begbie cat can still read my face.
This wee cunt will be straight back doing the fucking school, throwing his fucking poppy about to impress his fucking mates and all the wee birds.
No, I'll know, the wee guy says.
Shut the fuck up,
Begbie sneers.
The guy shites it again.
Begbie turns to us.
Fucking sure I'd be if it was me.
He stands up and throws three darts into this board on the wall. With real force, real violence, man. The wee guy's looking worried.
There's one fucking thing worse than a grassing cunt, he says.
Taking the darts out of the board and flinging them back into it with the same evil force.
And that's a fucking lippy cunt. The cunt that shoots his fucking mouth off always does more fucking damage than the grass. That's the cunts that fucking feed the grass. The grass feeds the fucking polis, then we're all fucked.
He flings a dart straight at the wee guy's face. A jump and the wee boy screams and starts grating hysterically, shaking like he's having a fit, like, see.
I see that Begbie's just flung the plastic flight, having slyly screwed off the metal spike and barrel before flinging it.
The wee guy's still greeting like he was shocking that.
The fucking flight, you daft wee cunt. A wee bit of fucking plastic.
Franco laughs scornfully and counts out a load of notes, but mostly just the coins for the wee man.
Polis stop ye. You won it for the shows at Porty or in a fucking arcade. Breathe a fucking word of this to any cunt, and you better fucking hope that the polis get a hood of ye and send ye to fucking Pullman before I fucking catch up with ye, you hear us?
Aye.
The wee boy's still trembling, like, see.
Now fuck off. Back to your fucking Saturday job at the DIY. Remember, if I fucking hear you flashing that fucking poppy around, I'll be right fucking doon to your bit before you ken what's fucking hit you.
The wee guy takes his dough and leaves.
Per wee cunt got nothing, really. About a couple of hundred quid, if he nears enough 5 grand, like, see.
Still, bags of loot for a cat that age, if you catch my drift.
Mind you, I still see that Franco's been a bit hard on the nipper.
Hey, man, that kid's made us a couple of grand each, man.
Just sort of saying, Franco, like, say, maybe you were a bit hard on the gadge, like, say, Ken.
I didn't fucking want that wee cunt boasting or flashing a fucking wad around. Doing anything with wee cunts like that, it's the riskiest fucking business gone. They've no fucking discretion, Ken. That's how I like to go screwing fucking shops and houses with you, Spud.
You're a true fucking professional like myself, and you never say nowt to nae cunt. I respect that fucking professionalism, Spud. When you got true professionals on a job, it's nae fucking problem, you cunt.
Yeah. Right, man, like say, I say.